Good morning, Mr. B.
That's right. Okay, it's time to get serious now. We've got a lot to go over if I'm going to get you ready for the test.
I was not told that to be honest.
Yes, you will have to name the artist, date, and title of every work I did not show you. But only up to World War II.
Excellent. I can just make things up.
All right. Welcome, welcome, everyone. Just like school.
If you can hear my voice, that's
yeah, right.
I think you just have to start talking.
I know. No, it's all right. People were literally walking.
Retired
shepherd. I know, right?
He's leading a bad example.
He's not a shepherd anymore. No accountability. Just goes out the door there.
We could just keep talking about whopping.
All right. Welcome, welcome everyone. I did not bring up a verse this week, but just to kind of remind you, there's a passage in Corinthians, and last week we looked at a passage in Romans, which just kind of indicates different ways of knowing, okay? A spiritual way of knowing versus a human or worldly way of knowing. And that for me, different ways of seeing are different ways of knowing, okay? And so my experience in learning about and making art has led me on a path of exploring different ways of seeing and understanding and knowing that I feel are analogous to, or at least open me up to being receptive to a spiritual way of knowing, I think is a good way to put that. And here, you know, a lot of art is about how do you define art and questioning what art is. And so here are some answers that you all gave a couple weeks ago when I posed this question. Different perspectives on what art is. And these ones in particular, I think, will be kind of appropriate to what we're looking at today. So, you know it when you see it. Art is about relationship. And then two very similar, expression of what's in your soul or a window into the artist's soul or psyche. All right. One of the things coming off of last week with when we looked at kind of the turn of the century, and you had art taking a couple different paths, one characterized by form in the artist Picasso with the invention of what's called cubism, and then the other looking at color, which is central to the art of Henri Matisse. But these artists become, I mean, all art has been sources for other artists. But these two in particular and what happened here really kind of set the stage for all the kind of redefinitions of art that came about through the 20th century. And one of the things, and you can kind of see it, I think, in both of these, whether it's form or color, is you kind of have a sense of this flattened picture plane, which was, in one sense, kind of an odd move because it seemed like you would think that art would get, in one sense, more realistic, or at least give the illusion of, you know, something that you're seeing. And so it was a major breakthrough in the Renaissance times when artists figured out this scheme of perspective to really make it appear that even though you have this flat painted surface, that there's an illusion of depth, right? This three-dimensional space. And so here you have these artists that kind of seem to be going the opposite direction. Picasso, in melding these different perspectives and viewpoints together, you don't get a sense of a lot of depth in that painting. right? As soon as you have some sort of shading that starts to lead you back, then you have another form or color that kind of pops out and everything kind of comes to the surface again. So everything's kind of compressed and flattened. And same with Matisse, with emphasizing the color relationships. And he was really into these patterns, these arabesque lines and patterns that he has in the tablecloth and the wallpaper behind that kind of blend together to almost kind of flatten that space. You have a little bit of perspective, like with the chair and the windowsill and the space behind, but by and large, most of the picture really kind of flattens out, starts to get away from that sense of depth. And so, interestingly enough, artists started thinking about the idea of being honest with what they were doing. If you think about perspective in kind of a classical Renaissance, where you're looking out into deep space, that's an illusion, right? It's kind of an optical trick. And one of the things that came about with one, the camera, and you didn't need to illustrate because now you can have a machine basically do it, right? Just snap a picture. But two, it really kind of got them thinking about what is painting. Painting is, at its very basic level, material, paint, on a flat surface. And so artists actually, it was almost kind of became somewhat of a moral imperative to be honest with the materials that they were using. So the idea of flattening out the picture plane and just focusing on the relationships of colors and forms on a flat surface really started to take the forefront. And particularly with Matisse, we read a lengthy quote from him last week where it was all about the sensations and these color relationships, right? He had a particular sensation of red, per se, and once he has red on there, he has to find the right shade of red, balance with the white of the canvas. That kind of pleased him. But as soon as he put some other colors in there, greens and yellows and blues, you had to kind of go back and forth and change the size of some of the shapes, slightly change their colors as different colors interact with each other differently. And so it kind of begs the question, if the expressive power of the picture, or what the artist is really trying to do, is balancing out these forms and shapes and colors on a flat space, the question then comes, why do you need to depict any sort of object at all? Even though these are somewhat abstracted, we can still recognize people and chairs and tables and fruit and things like that, right? But if the real power of the artwork is coming from the relationships of lines, colors, shapes, do those shapes and colors and lines need to actually depict objects? And so that was really kind of moving forward, this idea of really dealing with the flatness of the surface and solely just going on this relationship of colors and lines and shapes. So I'm going to start off with a couple of artists real quick that I'm not really going to talk about. I'm reminded, Kevin one time gave a sermon where, 3/4 of it was a lot of points that he was not going to talk about and not going to give a sermon about. I thought that was pretty genius, so I'm pulling a page from that book. Here's an artist named Franz Klein. All of the artists that we're looking at today, by the way, are from like the World War II era, late 40s, or right after World War II, late 40s, early 50s. And so this is an artist, Franz Klein, mostly kind of black and white, different shades of gray. You can maybe have some references to industrial you know, buildings and cityscapes and stuff like that, but by and large, pretty abstract, just brushstrokes on a white background. Incidentally, the one on the right there is actually owned by the comedian Steve Martin. They're imitating his own purchase. Steve Martin is actually a major art collector. Probably one of the biggest in the nation, actually. So, actually went and got to see in a show in Las Vegas, we went, and they had a show of just works in his collection. And the only time I've ever gotten one of those little audio, you know, tour guide things, I got because he was actually talking about the artwork. So it was interesting to hear from a collector's perspective what he saw in the work. So for a while, you could actually see this painting at the Portland Art Museum. Last few times I've been there, it hasn't been there, so I don't know if it's out of rotation or something. But okay, another artist that I'm not going to talk about is Willem de Kooning. One of the phrases that you hear about abstract expressionism or this abstract art from the 40s and 50s is the term action painting, where one critic talked about how artists were kind of seeing the canvas as a place to perform an event, right? The activity of painting was an active process. And the canvas was a space on which to perform this activity. And Willem de Kooning's works are very much emblematic of that. Interestingly enough, though, he did bring back in the early 50s a little bit of a figure, somewhat abstracted, but Picasso actually once saw these and said, oh, it's like melted cubism. He wasn't all that impressed, but anyways, so a funny story about Willem de Kooning is one time someone wanted to actually film him making a painting. And so the guy set up his camera and Willem got his canvas all ready. And then, yeah, he put on the show. He was jumping all over the place and slashing, you know, this paint across and, you know, visually performing what some of these look like. And, you know, after the scene, I mean, the paintings weren't really done, per se. But later on, the filmographer and saw Willem on the street and said, hey, how did that painting turn out? He said, it was garbage. I threw it away. And he's like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, I just did that for show. 80% of the time, I'm just sitting on my butt in the chair looking at the painting, trying to figure out what to do. It wasn't, this whole idea of action was more based off of what they look like, but, I mean, it was not, I mean, yeah, there's some action in moving the brushstroke, but they were not quite as active as a process as they look. A lot of times, it's sitting and looking is the activity of the artist. So, okay, so those are the artists I'm not going to talk about today. So last week we looked at, right, this changing world and the hope that the people had in this new technology and the machine age and industrialization. And since that time, we went through World War I, a world depression, and World War II, and you come from hope to an existential crisis. So one of the artists of this period, Jackson Pollock, said, my opinion is that new needs need new techniques. And the modern artists have found new ways and new means of making their statements. The modern painter cannot express this age, the airplane, the atom bomb, the radio, in the old forms of the Renaissance or of any other past culture. One of the definitions of art I did not put up this week, though, was paying attention. But I think this kind of shows to what extent the artist is paying attention to what's going on around him, right? What's going on in the world? What is the overall feeling of what's going on in the times and places and in the people around you, and paying attention to that and looking for sources, looking for means to express what's going on there. So, Jackson Pollock, there, looking like the troubled artist that he is, struggled with a lot of mental health issues, substance abuse. He was an alcoholic. I always emphasize to my students, however, that his most famous and best works came from the four-year period where he was getting help and was sober and was on medication. So take care of yourself, and you'll make great stuff. So the thing that interests me, this is him speaking, is that today painters do not have to go to a subject matter outside of themselves. Most modern painters work from a different source. They work from within. Okay, so kind of a shift from a quote we had last week from Cezanne at the turn of the century, let us go forth to study beautiful nature. Jackson Pollock is famously known for saying, I'm nature, right? People, we're part of the created order. And internally, you know, expressing kind of an internal self and emotional state of being is just as much looking at nature as looking at a tree or a piece of fruit or something. So he is most famous for these drip and splatter paintings
that are huge,
that are big. I don't think I put a picture. I was going to put a picture of a person standing next to him. They are pretty large. You'll see some. He started out, though, in the late 30s, mid to late 30s, kind of incorporating a style that's called surrealism. I didn't really talk about that too much, but it's think of like Freud and interpretation of dreams, right? These kind of esoteric symbols, dream worlds, dream landscapes. Surrealism kind of taps into that. So in one sense, representative of things, but those things may not necessarily be real, right? But you can still see early on some areas where the paint is pretty messy and kind of drippy. And, you know, it's sometimes artists, as we go along, a kind of side effect of some of the work that's in process becomes then kind of a major focus and theme later on. He was commissioned by a art patron named Peggy Guggenheim. If any of you have been to New York, there's the Solomon Guggenheim Museum. Solomon, I believe, is Peggy's uncle, but that whole family is big art supporters. Anyway, she had this big apartment in downtown New York and commissioned him to do essentially a mural piece for her entryway. And this painting is over 8 feet tall, 21 feet long, maybe, somewhere around there. It's big. And in fact, to be able to paint this, you know, he was a starving artist, lived in a very small space. He had one room that was his studio, his wife had another room that was her studio, and to be able to make this painting, what they did was they broke down the wall that divided the two rooms, so he had a single wall that was went along both rooms. Of course, they were just renting this. They couldn't let the landlord know. They would, you know, kind of quietly break it off and then break the drywall into little tiny pieces and put it in their pockets and then go for walks at night and just kind of... Yeah, they just really... totally. you know, to not let anybody know that they just, like, destroyed this apartment. But anyways, this was kind of more traditionally painted in that the painting was vertical and it was brushed on. But really just got into the sense of this rhythm of forms that may have started out somewhat, you know, dreamlike characters like this, but you just kind of continue that motion throughout. And it's more about the energy and the rhythm that's created. And then he hit upon the idea of actually dripping and splattering the paint. And so to do that, he had to put his canvases on the floor. And on the floor, he says, "I'm more at ease. I feel nearer, more a part of the painting, since this way I can walk around it and work from the four sides and literally be in the painting." In fact, there's some of these paintings, if you look up close, you can actually see his footprints. Or he got paint on his boots and was painting there. So, but you can kind of get a sense of how large some of these are. So that one he's painting right here is that one there, the final image. A lot of these just have numbers as titles, and we actually have a quote from another artist that talks about that. But in getting away from a subject matter outside of the self, and just concentrating on the relationships of lines and colors to create some sort of an effect, a lot of artists got away from titling their pictures because they didn't want to control the observer's response and interpretation. They wanted just as much as they were painting from what they were feeling and responding to what they're seeing. They wanted that process to continue with the observer, to where, you know, you bring your own internal state of mind to these works, and they either click with you or they don't. And sometimes they'll click with you, and other times they won't. So, when I'm in my painting, I'm not aware of what I'm doing. It is only after a sort of get acquainted period that I see what I have been about. I have no fears about making changes or destroying the image, etc., because the painting has a life of its own. I try to let it come through. It is only when I lose contact with the painting that the result is a mess. Otherwise, there is a pure harmony, an easy give and take, and the painting comes out well. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, I cannot tell the difference between when it's a mess and when it comes out well. And I don't know how to explain it other than try making one of these on your own. And it is actually incredibly difficult for all these colors not to just blend together and mush together and you just have a murky gray mess. The more you look at these, and I'm trying to show several of them so that you can kind of get a sense of the range of expression that can come about through these with the different colors and how either densely packed it is or kind of opened up. But I've had students try to make these and realize, wow, this is a lot harder than it looks. You think you can just kind of splatter it, and you can, but you can't. It's really, really hard to explain, but there is a difference, and there is some skill involved. And this idea of, you know, where he says it's only after a sort of get acquainted period that I see what I've been about. He would spend sometimes months on these. Not months painting, but he would have a painting session, and then it would be up, and he would be looking at it for a while and just dwelling on it and meditating on it and seeing what needs to be, you know, changed, what needs to be added to, what needs to be taken away, and then he might, you know, reapproach it in a month or so. Yeah?
What do you think it means when he says it is only when I lose contact?
Can you
repeat the question?
Yeah, Kevin asked what do I think he means when he says when I lose contact with the painting. I don't know if you may have heard of this book. I don't know if, how many of you read it. I haven't actually read it, but this book called Flow by Mikhail Chikmiskvahali. I don't know how to pronounce his name. But he talks about how artists and musicians and even athletes, they get into what's called this flow state, right? Where you're kind of in the zone, you know? You might be familiar with athletes who, you know, sometimes they're hot, right? They're in the zone, and other times they're having an off day. And I think it's that kind of a sense. Sometimes, you know, what you're doing and what you're thinking and feeling are really in tune with each other, and there's this connection, and there's this energy. And then sometimes you're distracted, and it seems like you're painting with your foot instead of your hand, and, you know, just things aren't gelling. And so I think, but I think it brings up an idea of really kind of being in tune with things and present with whatever it is you're doing and working on. So, yeah. Oh, we got a microphone coming over here.
I've never had an art class in my life, but I am just absolutely overwhelmed with the parallels and the similarities between this and what a musician goes through.
Mm.
They're almost, would you speak to that?
Yeah. You know, a lot of these artists, especially at this time, you know, coming out of the 30s and 40s, you had the development of jazz music. And I'm not a musician. I can't really speak to it too much on a technical level, but, you know, one of the things that I understand about jazz is you kind of have this basic structure, right, a basic chord structure, and then you have these artists that just kind of riff, right? They'll kind of go out this way and then bring it back to that structure, and then they'll go out this way and bring it back to that structure, and you have these different instruments, different musicians playing on this theme. And that's what a lot of these artists were doing too. There was a sense of structure that maybe they had in their mind. A lot of times it was just kind of what they were feeling at the moment. But then it was kind of a visual riff, right? Just kind of playing around with these materials. And then if it goes too far, you'd find ways to kind of bring it back to this cohesive structure. And yeah, it's very much in line with music. Oh, Marty has. We'll go with Marty since she has a microphone, and then we'll come to you.
Since this is abstract, I don't think he means for you to see movement as such in it, but I think I can actually see the vision of maybe a person in the center that goes, maybe a woman with a flowing gown that goes down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. If you see, there's some films of him painting. And sometimes he would actually start out, even though he's still kind of dripping, there's a very basic, still figurative aspect of, you know, starts out with a couple figures interacting somehow. And sometimes that would just kind of set the tone, the kind of theme, and then he would build upon that, and a lot of times that image, so to speak, disappears. But it actually it starts out a lot of times with a very definite sense in mind, not necessarily a definite image per se, but yeah, I mean, there's, you can Rorschach these in a sense, right? These Rorschach ink blot tests, where the psychologist shows you an ink blot and you have to, you know, just kind of talk about what you see and what it means. These are very much open to that. So, yeah.
I guess this ties kind of, I guess, both of those question, comment together. There's a great movie, and Michael can tell you. Yes, he has a funny, we have a funny story about the movie. But anyway, not to talk about today, but there's a movie called Pollock that was phenomenally done. Highly recommend it. And there's a scene, and I can't quote it exactly, but I'll paraphrase. he is having a conversation with his wife. Were they actually married?
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. She's also an artist.
I think so.
Whether or not they respected each other. Anyway. And they were kind of having an argument, discussion. Very different styles of painting. And he kind of talked about, you have to know the rules to break the rules. As he was moving into this thing, this type of style. And he said, every art starts with, like, as the paint falls from my brush, basically, there's a figure that comes, and then you break the figure, and then you bring the figure back, then you break the figure. She was kind of saying that was a bunch of baloney. But I think that's interesting. So same thing, like, you know, our son, when he is composing something, especially if it's a little bit more abstract, on his computer and piano, he'll talk about, I have to know all the rules so I can break the rules, so that I can bring enough of the rules back that it doesn't hurt your ears. Mm-hmm. And it's, I feel like that's kind of what Jackson Pollock was doing, was he was breaking enough of the rules, but then he would bring stuff back with that flow and movement and drip figures. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the side, like, because he talked about, he loved the curvature of the side of a woman, where it went from, you know, the torso to the hips. And I, knowing that now, I totally see that movement in so much of his thing. So I think it is this form breaking of rules and how they intersect.
Yeah.
So there is form there.
Very much so. Here's another one. And again, these numbers, so number 31, it wasn't necessarily the 31st painting that he did. A lot of times he had a bunch of paintings, and as they're taking them out to take them to the gallery to show them, he's standing at the door, one, two, three. Had to do with the order that they pulled him out of his studio. But then sometimes other names are attached to them, like one, number 31. I mean, so one, this kind of sense of oneness, of a unity, going throughout everything. Yeah.
There's this, you know, this tradition in Christianity associated with the Christian mystics that often talks about the process of naming, then unnaming, then renaming God. And part of what they suggest is that every time we name God, you necessarily get it wrong because it's too limited. God is always bigger than any name you offer God. And so then you unname God. And the way to name God is go through this process of unnaming so that you might name God even better. And some of that seems analogous to what you're talking about with Pollock in the way that he is undoing form to find a truer statement of whatever form it is he's communicating, but has to do it through the process of unnaming. And that has, again, significant parallels with the way that Christians approach God. There is a usefulness to naming God. We've got to have some words.
Yeah.
But then we always have to undo those words to get at the fuller truth of it all. And perhaps that hints at what Pollock is doing with paintings as well.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing I was thinking about with these is the aspect of actually communicating, you know, the artist communicating an idea, you know, how open-ended is that? Do I really want to communicate my idea or just leave it totally open so that it's whatever the beholder sees is, that's fine with it? And that gets a little tricky. We made connections with music, you know, in the 30s and 40s, there was this even break from the traditional tools of harmony and so forth. And they said, instead of harmony, we want to do atonality.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult for an audience to get accustomed to that. And
in fact,
things, I think, the movements have gone, well, probably even with art, there's a movement away from all the abstract.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because if you don't have enough of an audience, you know, unless you have a really wealthy patron like the Guggenheims or whatever, then the artist isn't going to be able to continue to producing.
Yeah.
And the world isn't going to appreciate it long enough or whatever. So there's the aspect of, is there enough stuff to hang your material on that is in common with the person that's observing it, right? So
yeah.
That there's some kind of continuity or communication that happens.
Yeah, very much so. And a lot of times that's just pure dumb luck somehow, so of who you're associated with and who you get connected with. You know, if you get connected with a Guggenheim or an art critic that champions your work. Yeah, I know of some artists that I think do phenomenally powerful work, but you would never hear about them in the art history, but, you know, they didn't, for some reason, those connections didn't gel, and they just go away. Yeah.
It makes me think of the importance of relationship that you talked about at the beginning, and that relationship with your observer, right, with your collectors, with your patrons, the way that you relate to what you're producing, how that relationship will impact other people, just all of those ways in which, and when you think about that with the spiritual lens, right, again, that importance of relationship when you're talking about change, when you're talking about struggle, when you're talking about challenges, right, that there's the foundation of how we kind of process together or commune together.
Yeah.
That makes me think of, I know you and I have had lots of conversations about this, and I think back to conversations that we've had with Ike, of when somebody asks you to paint during a sermon or a church service, and the challenge that it is if you're just going somewhere and it's a one-time thing that you don't know the audience versus a group of people who you've been able to bring on a journey, because especially bringing it in front of, for instance, like East County, there's this journey of, okay, the painting needs to look like something, to eventually, if I do this over time, I can take that group of people through a journey to I can then actually paint. To where at the beginning it's like, yeah, I was doing that for the people. This is a painting of the sermon or the whatever. But there's this communication, this relationship, you have to bring the people on to get them to be able to understand it. And I think about like Ike talking about Interpraise and Faith Quest. Like there was a conscious, like we've got to work. It's gonna take years to get them to be able to worship in the way that this can just freeform worship. And that art is that, it's that communication of there needs to be a journey, and you need to have people you can have dialogue with that you can allow them to see it. Otherwise, it looks like, yeah, my kindergarten can do that.
Yeah. Yep. So there needs to be rich people to buy this stuff and show it. It's hard to tell, maybe in this image, oh, wow, that looks really pixely. Bad quality picture. But, you know, again, it's hard to explain it. You kind of just have to experience it. But this is a later work after he had kind of fallen back into alcoholism. And seeing this in person, so you kind of have this background that seems traditional Jackson Pollock. But when you can see these in relationship to the other ones, and I was blessed by my wife to get his tickets to see a retrospective of his in New York several years ago. So basically had his entire career, all these paintings I've seen in person. So the difference between, you know, kind of the orange and yellow and cream and bluish background on this versus some of his other works like these, it's very different. This he was not in touch with the painting, and it was kind of a mess. And some of his fellow artists were kind of helping him out, and they end up taking, I think, some 2x4s or just some pieces of wood, and they'd slather this really dark bluish black paint on the wood, and then they laid it down over the top to kind of create these lines that they give it the name Blue Poles. And that provided a sense of structure to kind of contain what was kind of bubbling beneath the surface. So it's just very interesting. Once you kind of get in tune with some of these, you do start noticing some things that are, you know, some splatters are better than other splatters. It's a different way of seeing, a different way of knowing. It's knowing physically, like viscerally, rather than just looking at something, if that makes sense. So, all right, next artist I want to talk about at length in the next minute. We'll go over, sorry. Is Mark Rothko, around the same time. And a note about titling, I don't put any titles on these because they're just numbers. The pictures will be without titles. This is actually him writing in an exhibition catalog. Only identified by numbers. Risking the charge of affectation, I am omitting titles because they would inevitably mislead the spectator and delimit the meanings and implications latent in the work. So it's a very deliberate... I mean, yes, you're communicating and wanting to make a statement, but you're also not wanting to make necessarily like a proposition in a like logical argument purpose. Not a statement of a fact, but kind of an expression of where I'm at, and does that connect with you? And if it doesn't, fine, we go on our separate ways, and if it does, great. This kind of design may look simple, but it really takes me many hours to get the proportions and the colors just right. Everything has to lock together. I guess I'm pretty much a plumber at heart. If any of you have tried to connect that pipe to this pipe and you got to go around things just have to lock together, and sometimes that's more challenging than others. When I recognize myself in a work, then I realize it's completed. If you remember, I kind of had that experience when I had that piece, what I consider my first real painting, where I knew it was done when I could see myself, when I could see what I was feeling and thinking during the time I was making that. And it's a phenomenal experience. And it happens sometimes with just when viewing a work. Right, something really connects with you. And again, part of this is we as spectators are just not going to be looking at artwork as much as the artists are. And that's just a fact, but it's also why sometimes we don't understand these works, right? Because they see so much more because they just spend time. Right? He would lie on the couch or here sitting in a chair for hours saying nothing, just looking and contemplating at this picture. Yeah.
Can I have the audience turn around and look at the picture up there because it's a little different?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the colors are a little bit more vivid on the screen back there. The projector sometimes kind of washes these things out. He too started kind of in a surrealist vein, so especially that picture on the left. There's some definite figures there, almost kind of Egyptian hieroglyphic looking in a sense. But maybe you can kind of see the progression of changing those to just kind of somewhat amorphous areas of color. Oops. And it gets fewer and fewer until he kind of arrives at his, quote, mature style. The progression of a painter's work as it travels in time from point to point will be towards clarity, toward the elimination of all obstacles between the painter and the idea, and between the idea and the observer. So that just comes with the looking. You kind of pare things down, trying to get to what is essentially what's going on, and how can I get rid of everything that gets in the way, and how can I bring forward and emphasize those key relationships that are carrying the emotional effect of the piece. So, paint very large pictures. All of these guys did at that time. The reason I paint them is precisely because I want to be very intimate and human. So if you paint a small picture, I'll just kind of paraphrase him here. Paint a small picture, right? You are outside of that picture, and you're looking at this object. The idea of painting large, and you can see how tall some of those paintings were, is the idea that almost to create an environment. You know, Jackson Pollock talked about literally being in his paintings as he's making them. These artists also wanted the viewers to kind of experience that. If you're looking at a painting, and, you know, especially if you're standing up close, where most of your visual field is that painting, right? Wanting to immerse you in that experience. As he says here, it isn't something you command, right? It's not something you can control. You kind of have to be receptive at that point. And so the scale was for a purpose, but he also saw that it could work against him. And this is kind of an interesting point, I think. Since my pictures are large, colorful, and unframed, and since museum walls are usually immense and formidable, there's the danger that the pictures relate themselves as decorative areas to the walls. This would be a distortion of their meaning. Since the pictures are intimate and intense, and are the opposite of what is decorative, and have been painted in a scale of normal living rather than an institutional scale. He would often, there was a story of a collector going to the gallery to buy one of his pieces, and the dealer said, "I would be happy to sell this to you. You need to go talk to the artist first, because he's very picky about who buys his artwork. He wants to make sure that the experience, right, that it's not just going to go into a museum somewhere. The scale is to give you an experience, and if you're already in a large, expansive space, then it diminishes the effect that the painting can have on you. Mm-hmm. So again, kind of a different thing to think about, right? We think about art as making this painting or this object. And here the artists are realizing, you know, the context of this painting and this object affects things. And we'll actually delve into that more later on. He was commissioned to do a chapel that's down in Houston, Texas. It's an octagonal space, and he has paintings, large paintings on every wall. You can kind of see the scale with the little people there. And so this idea of painting large and fitting the scale of the space, as he was working, I mean, he was working with the architect. They were kind of working together to build the space and to come up with these paintings. And so he would actually, once they kind of got the plan down, he actually would recreate at least individual walls within a studio. He had to get a large space and build walls so that he can make the painting for that wall, for that space. All right, either their surfaces are expansive and push outward in all directions, or their surfaces contract and rush inward from all directions. Between these two poles, you can find everything I want to say. Yeah?
I don't struggle with art. I absolutely love art. But I've struggled with the connection between spirituality and art a little. Mm-hmm. But I'm beginning to see that it is a way of approaching it's holiness is what it is. And it is that artist's way of seeing that they are hoping you will also see
I think we think in such binary terms. I like it, I don't like mm-hmm. it. I, you know, doesn't appeal to me, they don't appeal to me. When I think, trying to understand what's behind the expression is part of our spiritual work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to meet somebody and realize how complicated they are, that's a challenge, you know, and that was Jesus's challenge,
mm-hmm.
to look in the face of people and see what lies behind.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I'm starting to get it, Michael.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, you know, very much so, you know, as artists are dealing with these, you know, lofty ideas and trying to embed them in their work somehow, it's as much developing a painting as developing themselves, right? As they're sitting and looking, they're changing in a very much the same way as you know, times of silence or contemplative prayer or any sort of ritual can do for us, right? The goal is inner transformation. And so not only are you expressing yourself, but you're also seeing yourself expressed and letting that affect you and change you. So Rothko was very much on my mind when I was doing this work here, and this idea of, you know, pushing out and pulling in. So I have a couple, well, this is the final image here, but this is the first stage of the painting. I had this idea of kind of a blackened space and this yellow background, and some other things I'll get into here. But, you know, in standing back and looking at it, I really got that sense of this yellow is too strong, right? Everything's shrinking in and compressing in the middle. And I had to bring that black out and balance it a little bit. And, you know, it doesn't show up as well in the picture, but really spending a lot of time on that edge. How do you feather this yellow and this black together in just a way that it's not a smooth blend, but it's not just like a harsh edge either? That takes a lot of work. But this idea of, you know, art coming from art. When I was making this painting, I had Rothko on my mind, and that quote in particular. I had one of my professors at Pepperdine, his work, Joe Pezzentine, in mind, with these kind of little oval shapes, and also he had a very textured mixed media, you know, put stuff on the canvas approach. And then another professor of mine from graduate school, John Millay, who's a lot of his current work is dealing with these little flower shapes, and I was really intrigued with the flower stems and kind of the lines that they made. And so, you know, pulling those together in kind of a Rothko-esque type shape of space, I had to, once I kind of figured out what I was doing, this kind of get to know you period, right? Put it down and read it back and see what's going on. I actually had to change the orientation of my little leaf forms as I kind of came up with a scheme of, you know, this textured area, which is in the shape of the city of Jerusalem, and how that would interact with the forms, and then these like little stems from the leaves that are also kind of pathways in a sense. You know, it's this kind of give and take, but you know, a lot of it is, you know, I'm sure as, you know, musicians will take music that they hear and they'll kind of play around with their own variations. Artists do the same thing. As we look at other artwork, we're like, oh, I need to try something like that and incorporate it into their own work there. So different ways of seeing. I should have had this blank to hear more from you, but we're also kind of running out of time. Here's some things that just stuck out to me, but this idea of dialogue, of art coming from art. You know, Kevin mentioned a tradition of mystic Christians in particular, but like church fathers, right? Our relationship to Christians that have come before us, our relationship to the biblical writers, our lives and our practice being in dialogue with them. Relationships both within the painting with proportions of colors and shapes, but also scale, right? The relationship of the painting or the artwork to our bodies, the relationship of the artwork to the space. Different things to think about. Interior sources versus exterior objects. Expressing something versus illustrating something. Just different perspectives on the art-making process, the art-seeing process, that I think can have some spiritual parallels as well. Who are we in relationship with or dialogue with? How does the space and scale of things around us affect our practices and our, you know, spiritual journeys from that? So I think that's all I have for today. Thank you very much for your time and attention. Oh, we got some comments. Final comments, questions. Someone want to bring the mic over?
Theoretically, in music, I know that in a triad, if I raise the fourth, it's going to, 90% of the time, initiate a certain feeling mm-hmm. within the listener. Are there manipulatives like that in art? It's not really manipulative, it's just part of it. In art that generate feeling.
Yeah, yeah. There's certain color combinations and color theory about, you know, both colors that harmonize together, but also colors that clash and things like that. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you intentionally want to make a painting that doesn't look pretty because you want that, that effect. I have a story of my professor, Joe Pezentine, went to a museum, saw some artworks, all these big names that he had heard about in his art history classes, loved them, saw this painting by this artist that he thought was just absolutely awful, just ugly. But he went back home, and he realized that was the only painting that was still in his mind. Well, a week later, he was still thinking about that painting. He's like, I saw these other things that I knew about and heard about, but this is what stuck with me. And sometimes it was that ugliness, right? This atonality or something that, that has a stronger emotional effect that will stay with someone longer than something that works. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Oh, I thought I turned this off.
How many more sessions do you have?
Hold on, I'm trying to figure out how to turn this off.
ones there to weep.
Never is shy.